My main response to the world is not one of anger. As I get older, I find it's one of disappointment. One of disappointment.
I was so disappointed by the events of the day.
Everybody will be so disappointed.
I'm very disappointed.
Hi, I'm Wendy, and you're listening to So Disappointed, the podcast that asks you about some of the things that have really let you down. Disappointment comes in so many forms. Maybe you've been disappointed by a film or television franchise, an artist you admire, a political figure, an ideology, or just the human race in general. The permutations are endless. We'll be looking at why we get so invested in people and things to such an extent that we get angry when they let us down. Why do we care? What's wrong with us? What's wrong with them? In this episode, we'll be looking at how disappointing it is when public figures we like and admire become part of the establishment. That is, when they accept so-called honours such as knighthoods and OBEs. If you've ever listened to this irredeemably woke lefty snowflake show before, then it will come as no surprise to hear that we regard all monarchical dynasties as ludicrous anachronisms which should be abolished with immediate effect. In other words, this is a No Kings podcast. But while they're still around, we just have to grudgingly accept that people who were once regarded, rightly or wrongly, as having at least some degree of integrity, will one day let us down by trooping up to Buckingham Palace to receive a pat on the head. Why does this bother us? These honours are, after all, essentially meaningless. And there's an almost arbitrary double standard at play here. We're fully aware of that. It stands to reason, for example, that David Attenborough has received a knighthood for his services to broadcasting and conservationism. If we accept that honours are a thing, and they are, then fair play, Sir Dave. You deserve yours. But Sir Mick Jagger? That erstwhile symbol of the counterculture, a man who once caused outrage with his lewd and lascivious rock and roll ways. Has he tarnished his legacy by becoming a fully paid-up member of the establishment? Or is it just stupid of us to care about such things? After all, Jagger's shtick was an act, a pose, a studied persona. And really, we knew all along that he was a nice middle-class boy with plums in his mouth. However, there is no denying that we admire, even more so than we already did, those public figures who turned down honours. People like Alan Bennett, David Bowie, and Malcolm McDowell, to name but three. They did not accept endorsements from the man. They never bowed before the ruling classes, and at the risk of sounding like a 90s teenager who's just discovered Bill Hicks for the first time, that's kind of cool. This whole argument is complicated, nuanced, and probably quite pointless, but hey, that's never stopped us in the past. So, let's get into it.
Hides the crime rates. Councilwoman hesitates. Public gets irate, but forgets to vote dates. Weatherman complaining. Predicted sun, it's raining. Everyone's protesting. Boyfriend keeps suggesting. You're not like all of the rest.
What do they owe us?
Nothing. We should not put celebrities or public figures on as high a pedestal as we do. And if we do, then that's just... what's the word? Parasocial and wrong. And it's stupid to believe that although one person said one thing at one point in their life, then they still stand by those facts or they ever truly meant those facts. But to put entire or even a little bit of faith in a public figure who you've never met, who you've never had an actual conversation with. Because if you talk to them at a meet and greet, if you talk to them at in public, they are their persona. They are their public version of themselves because they don't truly have... They can't show that true self because that would skew their image. They might not be... Taylor Swift might not be big and powerful and energetic and always talking about her newest ex-boyfriend, she might actually have interests and you might not be interested in them and you might just be interested in talking about how relatable her newest album was. But she might not care about that. She might have been slaving away at that album for 3 months and now she doesn't want to talk about it anymore. So to think of these celebrities as just what they are in the public eye is parasocial, wrong, and downright stupid because you have no clue who that person is.
That was an excerpt from my conversation with series regular Sprite, who you'll be hearing more from later. But right now, let's commune with our resident psychologist, David Myers. David, is receiving a knighthood, accepting an honorific title from the establishment, the ultimate act of selling out?
If we really strongly identify with someone, if we think of them as somehow like us or a part of our social group, if they then go and do something which goes against the grain of everything that you expect of them or everything that that group stands for, then I guess you would see them as a sellout. They've betrayed you, they've betrayed people like them. And if I'm not saying he's done this, but say a really well-known, let's pick a really well-known working class comedian, Kevin Bridges. If he were to take a seat in the House of Lords, it would probably seem quite out of character, particularly for people who grew up in his area. And I declare an interest because I was at the same primary school as him. So that's why that I've given that as an example. So yeah, if he then did something which seemed really kind of odd or not in keeping with his character or what you know of him, then you would probably feel quite hurt by that, betrayed by it. If it's a real friendship and or if the relationship is parasocial, we'll go back to that. It's a relationship you can't possibly influence, you still would take some sort of negative reaction towards that.
We talked about this in the Star Wars Episode 1 podcast episode. You discussed the fact that when something like that happens and it threatens the group then almost sort of becomes even more coherent in their dislike and distrust towards the thing that's threatening them.
Yes.
And it becomes all bad. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no nuance there. It's just this thing bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember in terms of the kind of the comedy industry, I know that's one of the people, the sort of groups of people you pointed to in the introduction. I remember this happening to Billy Connolly back in the 1980s, simply for the fact that he... had moved away from Scotland, went to live in LA, and was riding the crest of a wave of his fame, you know. But, and I don't know if this has a lot to do with a sort of really kind of Calvinist, Presbyterian, Scottish attitude that we have. We don't like tall poppies here. So because he went and did something which was completely alien to his Glaswegian roots, I remember him being pilloried in the press.
Yes.
Simply for going and being famous somewhere else. He hadn't changed as a person. His values hadn't changed. He was just doing something against the grain. Now, in the 1980s, celebrity culture wasn't as prevalent as it is now. But, you know, he was probably the most famous Scot that there was at that point. So because he'd abandoned us in the eyes of the press. He hadn't. Uh-huh. he became persona non grata almost. It was very interesting.
We interrupt this episode to explain the concept of tall poppy syndrome. It means to bring someone down to size, i.e. lopping the head off of the tall poppies so they're the same size as the rest of the garden. Apparently it comes from Australia or New Zealand, but to me it feels like a very Scottish phrase because we really don't like people getting too big for their boots.
I am just double checking. Billy Connolly's got a knighthood, doesn't he?
I don't know.
Sir.
Okay.
Sir William Connolly.
But I don't think he's had a similar reaction to that.
No.
I don't remember one.
No.
But because he moved to LA, he was no one.
He sold out. He left us. Mm-hmm. It was the same with Andy Murray, sir. Andy Murray, when he moved over to America, and obviously the man has like powerful mirror neurons which were firing like crazy because he picked up an accent. But mm-hmm. most people, well, a lot of people in that situation would pick up an accent, and he was absolutely derided for losing his Scottish accent. So it can go down to that sort of granular level in terms of selling out, from moving away, stepping away from your roots, yeah. all the way up to accepting a knighthood. But for some reason, because Billy has moved from the Biggin to living in America and try to get big in Hollywood to absolute national treasure. When he dies, we will be lining the streets.
Oh,
it's all right for him to have a knighthood now. In fact, I missed the fact that he had one.
Mm-hmm.
But he was he anti-establishment? Yes, he was. Of course he bloody was. Of course he bloody was. But it was his comedy was never political.
There's probably a few different things going on, and comedians are interesting because if we think about the olden days, the fool or the court jester had a very specific role. Yeah, he worked for the king, and he was there to entertain, but he was also there to point out the obvious through humour. The jester or the fool was the only person in the court who could get away with saying the wrong thing. So comedians have always, I guess, carry on that tradition. And the psychology of the comedian is quite interesting because it's a bit like being able to analyse information, situations, etc., anything going on through a different lens. You play with the language, you play with what you're seeing, you look at things from completely different perspectives. You can do it in a really kind of serious way, a dry way, or the utterly absurd. You get a laugh. That's the whole point of it. And a good comedy makes you laugh, but it maybe also makes you think at the same time. And that's what the fool was. So the fool wouldn't, I guess, be ennobled at any point. He wouldn't ever have any credibility, I guess, if that were to happen. So I guess if a comedian were to be in a similar situation today, and I can't think of an example off the top of my head of somebody who has joined the establishment, if you like, but they would potentially lose all of their power as a comedian. Like, what's the point of you? You've become the thing. And then, you know, they quite often, particularly the political guys, is they are standing there and pointing at the stuff that's going on, going, are you for real? That's real. And they're doing it on behalf of everybody else. And they do it in quite a powerful way. And you know, good comedy is really, really powerful that way.
But have we got this all wrong? Are we perhaps holding up certain comedians, especially those who deal with politics in their work, to an unfairly high standard? Let's take, as an example, Armando Iannucci, the Scottish writer, producer, director, and performer, whose vast list of credits includes some of the greatest comedies of the last four decades. We're talking about classics such as On the Hour, The Day to Day, Knowing Me, Knowing You with Alan Partridge, I'm Alan Partridge, The Thick of It, Veep, and Death of Stalin. I know, that's quite a roll call. Armando Iannucci is a satirist and parodist who combines a love of silliness, for silliness' sake, with an undercurrent of anger, bewilderment, and existential despair. So, when he accepted an OBE in 2011 and later a CBE in 2024, a substantial number of his fans and admirers felt quite let down. This is a man who'd spent years mocking the puffed-up absurdity of news programmes and the insidious, darkly farcical inner workings of Western politics. Surely he, of all people, shouldn't be kowtowing to the establishment. Here now to discuss this and quite a bit more are So Disappointed's co-producer Paul Whitelaw and the author, artist, pop culture historian and friend of the show, Justin Lewis.
When Armando Iannucci accepted his CBE, that caused a bit of a stink at the time, didn't it? Do you remember?
Yeah, and hasn't he accepted another one in recent times as well? Because that was quite a while back, wasn't it? Isn't there a CBE, but he's also... Yeah, he was an OBE in the 2012 birthday honours, the Queen's birthday honours in 2012, and now a CBE as well.
He's fully honoured up then. the thing about him, we're not going to focus just on Armando Iannucci, but he's an interesting example. The thing about him, I think people held him to a higher standard because A, he's a political satirist, and also someone whose work is very irreverent and certainly seemed to show no great respect for the establishment, and yet there he is, OBE and CBE. Do you think that's why people were disappointed in him in particular?
Well, I suppose the thing with him, it's funny because I remember reading an interview with him very, very early on when On the Hour was still on the radio. So this is how long ago that was. And I think it was in the Independent newspaper. And I think it was the first time I ever saw a picture of Chris Morris as well. There was a picture of them in the studio.
Right.
Making On the Hour. And they both said something about how they weren't sort of party political. I think they both said that. And in the sense of comedy, at least. Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, you just said political satirist just then, and it comes up a lot. The trouble is with that, I always think, is that it does mean that, I mean, I tend to run a mile from the word satirist now anyway, because, and I don't even know if Armando himself welcomes that term or not. I think he probably would prefer writer or comedian or whatever. The trouble with satire as a term or satirist is, I think the establishment likes that because it makes them feel important. It's like a thing of, oh, well, you know, oh, he's having a go at politics, you know, or you know, he's taking the piss out of the news or whatever it is. But a lot of what he does, I mean, I know he's doing a podcast now, Strong Message Here, is it called? Which I haven't really heard much of that. But that stuff often interests me less than what he does that's about social satire anyway. I think he's, you know, what a lot of his stuff is about language and how we use language. And I mean, literally his PhD, which he never finished, was about the religious language in John Milton. And so I think a lot of what he does isn't... I don't think some of what he does is necessarily as much about politics as people think it is. I think The Thick of It, for example, which, yes, all right, superficially it is about sort of spin doctors and so on, but actually, you could say it's about all sorts of workplaces. I mean, Malcolm is the terrifying boss who's coming to dinner, right? That's an awful lot of the dynamic of the thick of it is a lot to do with that. And it's sort of the fact that it's about government is kind of, I find sometimes it's incidental. And I think people forget that a lot of the time the thick of it's just really silly as well. It's not just about, oh, this is very important. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of that thing. Because I think it's always, people always think that comedy is really easy. People always think that. None more so than sort of political hacks. You all think when they write in their parliamentary sketches, they all think they're terribly chalklesome. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing more painful to read for the most part. They're nearly all terrible.
Politicians being funny is just the worst.
And you know, like political journalism on television trying to be funny as well. Oh, it's just absolutely awful. So I've always found that, you know, I noticed that quite a lot of establishment political figures, who, you know, because they do this thing of, oh, well, Armando's part of the establishment, where, you know, after that. And I think to myself, well, yeah, but a lot of you're not accepting honours, but you're in the, maybe no names, but, you know, Andrew Neil, you know, Alistair Campbell, or, you know, they all think they're being terribly rebellious, but they're all doing client journalism to some extent. And, you know, I just find it all a bit laughable, really. I mean, I used to find Andrew Neil's This Week is a great example of something where I just thought, wow, this is a bit like if you did a program about politics and thought it was all terribly chummy and funny. But it's not at all. I used to find it absolutely painful to watch, and it had that feeling of, oh, we're all in a club, we all went to school together. It's like that, and I'm not, you know, I know Armando didn't exactly go to a secondary mod neither, but it's that thing of, it's that thing where they are terribly, terribly pleased with themselves while nothing changes, and so I think it's funny how comedians are always held, or people in comedy are always held to a much higher standard than anybody else.
But you kind of, you have to be careful what you wish for. That, no, it's, I mean, the opposite, okay, of being right, so, right.
Somewhere at the thick of it arose a real genuine frustration and anger that, in my particular case, that we could go to war with Iraq despite millions of us protesting in the street and every expert in the UK and across the world saying this would be a disaster, and it proving the case. And I took that sense of frustration, that sense that politicians weren't really connecting with the people, and produced something like The Thick of It, which was also looking at the notion that politicians were concentrating more and more on a smaller and smaller group of people. The Middle England, the squeezed middle, the tiny amount of people who can swing an election. And in the course of doing that, just taking for granted everyone else. And as the years have gone by, that group of people we've taken for granted has become like 80%, 85%, which is why you get this level of frustration.
The thing is, half the time I forget who's even been knighted. And I mean, I have a rule that when I'm writing about people myself, that I would, you know, if they've been knighted, I would never write Sir Michael Caine.
No.
It's Michael Caine. I would never write, you know, we're talking about, you know, I hate the word term national treasures, but, you know, somebody like, I mean, Michael Palin is a sir, but I never think of him as that. I doubt even Michael Palin thinks that for the most part. Or David Attenborough, you know, or Judi Dench, or, you know, it's sort of, I'm sure they have their reasons for accepting it. And I mean, I have a feeling that some of it is to do with helping with, maybe it helps with whatever charity stuff they do, or maybe, I don't know, maybe it opens doors in that way. I have no idea. And you know, speaking as somebody who is unlikely to ever be offered anything like that, I you know, I suppose you might say it's easier for me to say that, but I don't, like, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I it's interesting. I looked at all the people who turned them down, right? I don't know if you've done this in real research, and it's kind of interesting. There's an interesting certain responses. So, I mean, it's interesting that Palin has accepted a knighthood and Cleese has turned down honours, which is kind of interesting. Because you might have thought it might be the other way round, but but then is that just because I like Palin more than I like Cleese these days? That's hard, you know. That's you've kind of also got to bear that in mind as well. You know, am I just biased because of who you prefer as people? I mean, my favorite. I've got a list here. And all the, you know, like my favorite one is ironically another person who works in topical comedy, John Oliver. Whose mm-hmm. response when he was offered the OBE was, "Why on earth would I want that?" Which I enjoyed reading that.
Yeah.
But there's quite, you know, it's sort of, it doesn't, I mean, Michael Frayn mm-hmm. apparently declined a knighthood in a CBE. He liked the sound of his ordinary name, which I totally get that as well. You know,
it's, I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's sort of, and then you get people like, I mean, Ken Loach's quote was, "It's not a club you want to join when you look at the villains who've got it," which is all very well, but there are people that you like who've got them as well. So it doesn't quite fit, does it? But yeah, I just find it. I mean, my favourite one is, I mean, I tell you, the one I find really weird is Sir Mick Jagger, I find very strange.
Well, this is my favourite, but go on, Justin. Tell me.
You know the story here, I take it, which is that.
Yeah.
Which is that the Queen, she was just so that she didn't have to meet him in person, she scheduled to have knee surgery for the day before that ceremony. So she didn't have to meet him, which I did think to myself, I wonder what that meeting would have been like. And of course, it didn't happen. So,
yeah. So which is very funny because the Queen's obviously still thinking of Jagger as this oik from the 60s, this troublemaker. And of course, the funny thing about the Mick getting the knighthood was that it really annoyed Keith Richards, which his reaction, he was livid, wasn't he? So it was worth it for that as well.
I mean, going back to Armando, the idea that his work is meant to stand as anti-establishment, I've never really been entirely convinced that it is, really. I mean, it's not like, because in order for that, you'd have to think, well, has his body of work changed anything in political life? And you might even argue it's actually not helped it at all. And I don't think he ever claimed it would. I mean, it's sort of, you know, the news is even more ridiculous now than it used to be. So, and as we say, you know, that now that everyone's trying to have a sense of humour about what they do. I mean, did you see that, all that stuff yesterday where they were trying to just fill in while for the new government, all this kind of thing, and they were just absolute rubbish, you know. And and so I never am quite convinced that there's a sort of that, you know, people in politics love to pretend that they're going to change things, and you do from time to time get people who do that, but mostly it's and you know, accepting the fact that very few individuals are able to do things on their own. Mm-hmm. I suppose that's another thing to bear in mind, but I guess. But I mean, I just think people are a bit. People get very funny about how comedy is supposed to change things and how it's held to this idea of, what am I trying to say? This idea that it's supposed to have this massive impact on things, and I just think the news has not really recovered from this idea that it's supposed to have a sense of humor. Who said it should, really? I mean, it's not like that's not, it was fatal for it to kind of cave in and think, oh, we've all watched the day to day, it's about us, let's start to do stuff that's in that spirit. And it's like, no, that's not, you've totally missed the point.
And here I am chatting to Dave Myers again.
So last week we lost Sam Neill,
yes.
Who was, as far as we can all tell, and certainly it's now been a week since he passed, and no one's had a bad word to say about the man. It sounds like he was an absolute dude. Mm-hmm. And certainly during his life, when he was kicking about doing his Sam Neill thing, he certainly seemed like a dude. And he is quoted in his BBC obituary as saying that he accepted a knighthood from, so sorry, I'm quoting the BBC article here. Neil accepted a knighthood from New Zealand in 2022 after previously having rejected one when titular honours were reintroduced by the New Zealand government in 2009. He made light at the time of how his cancer diagnosis changed his decision to accept the honour. And this is a quote directly from Sam Neill. I said I didn't want the title for 10 or 12 years, he told ABC in 2023. Then when I thought I was dying a couple of years ago, I thought, oh, bugger it. I may as well go out with the title. So I changed my mind. And I thought it was incredible because it gives you that immediate insight into what's going on in someone's mind. Sam Neill, a very gentle rebel, but very definitely a rebel throughout his life. Just going, bugger it, make me a sir, carry on.
And fair enough, you know, it's a free world and the people are allowed to make choices. And, you know, everybody's allowed to have an opinion about it, but really what that person's choice is none of anybody else's goddamn business at the end of the day.
We all mellow as we get older though, don't we? We all change.
We do. Our priorities change, particularly, you know, as you grow older, if you've had a family, if you've had kids, your view of life and your view of the world changes. There's maybe fewer things to be angry about or angry with or directing projected anger towards, and more things that you want to look after. Like, you'd want to, as you psychologically settle down, you start to think about what you're going to leave behind at certain, you know, and what Sam Neill said there encapsulates that quite nicely, I think.
So we've talked a little bit about what's going on for the person. Maybe they've changed, maybe they've mellowed as they've grown older. And we've talked a little bit about what the role of that person might have been and our expectations of that person and how that can be really hurt when they sell out. What's happening inside us as we watch our heroes knighted by King Charles, whom as we know is actually called Prince Charles?
I wonder if there's maybe something else going on. If we still really hold kind of anti-establishment or anti-authority or anti the man views, and they've become quite an important part of our identity, and I guess they still would be if the famous person who was part of our in-group is sort of verging towards going towards the out-group. We've already established that that's a threat to us. But why is it a threat to us? Well, we think it's maybe going to threaten the group or threaten the integrity of the group in some way. It maybe also threatens our idea of the world. So part of what we think we know to be true about the world is what we latch our identity onto when we're part of that social group. So if someone then goes against that, then I think perhaps it holds a mirror up to us as individuals. We don't think about this consciously, I don't think, but I suspect if we think about it from a sort of Freudian perspective, that sort of situation sets up a bit of an internal conflict. The kind of famous radical figure is almost like it's called an externalized ego ideal. So they almost have, you're projecting a lot of the kind of positiveness about your identity as anti-establishment onto that person when they are seen as anti-establishment.
Well, I am like Stuart Lee because I have the same ideals as Stuart Lee. And look how cool Stuart Lee is, therefore I'm cool.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
However, if Stuart Lee then goes over and supports the establishment, his life has changed somehow, but yours hasn't.
Yeah.
Part of you might be quite envious of that, quite jealous of that, as well as quite threatened of that. And so unconsciously, you're starting to project your own guilt and own disappointment in yourself with the fact that your life hasn't got to the point where you could be part of the establishment because you've not had that level of social mobility yet. And you project all that negativity in yourself onto that person. So that's one explanation from a particular psychological perspective about why or how the strength of the negative emotion is so big.
So instead of seeing my own failure, I project my envy onto whoever it is.
Yeah.
And then see them as somehow failing. They've failed themselves. They've let themselves down. Yeah.
They've let themselves down. They've let the group down. They've let the cause down. They've let you down. But really, because your life's stuck, have you really let you down? But that's too uncomfortable to consciously think about. So it's easier to be angry at them.
Time now to check in with our so disappointed Gen Z correspondent, Sprite Kirkwood, who, as always, will be speaking on behalf of every single young person in the world. Sprite, what is the establishment?
The Fire Nation.
I have no idea what this means.
My generation will.
Okay. Were it not the Fire Nation?
The Galactic Empire.
Oh, was that a Star Wars reference?
Yes. The first one was an Avatar reference. The Last Airbender, not the James Cameron one.
If only I understood your language.
Mm-hmm.
No. It's neither of those things.
Yes, it is. Well, no, those are both fascism. But so is the establishment. Mm.
Is it, though?
Yes.
Okay. So, maybe it is. Yeah, okay. So, for our purposes, mm-hmm. The establishment is...
The establishment is the guy on the top. And of course it's a guy because patriarchy.
It's going to be a white guy on the top,
it's a white
right?
guy who's blonde and he has a terrible orange tan and he's blonde and he himself on live TV. I can't say that.
We're going to beep all of that. Well, no, because Trump is not the establishment.
No, he's just a...
He'd... We're going to have to beep that as well. Could you stop?
Okay.
He desperately wants to be the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
That actually, this is a perfect example. When King Charles, who, as my generation know, is actually Prince Charles, when King Charles went to America and met Trump relatively recently... Trump's social media team posted out two kings together or something along those lines mm-hmm. because Trump is desperate to be part of the establishment. And what the establishment means in this situation is the monarchy, the people in charge, the old money, the upper classes, the landed gentry. You know, these are the people who are basically running the whole damn show.
Mm-hmm.
And what you find is that even when you get your ridiculously rich and unbelievably corrupt billionaires, they still can't reach that level because mm-hmm. you have to kind of be born into it.
Mm-hmm.
So at the moment, Nigel Farage, boo, is trying... You were meant to boo with me.
Oh, boo.
Nigel Farage.
Boo. Boo.
Thank you. Nigel Farage... is blaming all of his problems on the establishment. Nigel Farage is nothing but the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
Nigel Farage is old money, went to private school, has a seat in Westminster. Mm-hmm. He is absolutely 100% yeah. the establishment.
So have you brought me on to explain what the establishment is, and then you've just explained what the establishment is?
Yes, I'm not expecting you to explain what the establishment is. I'm expecting you to ask what the establishment is.
But you told me to come on and explain what the establishment is.
Well, that was so that we could then explain what the establishment is, because it's not always clear.
In you explaining to me what, in you asking me what the establishment is, we have set a precedence for the listener of this podcast to assume that I know what the establishment is and you don't. So you explaining what the establishment is after asking me what the establishment is just then makes it rhetorical.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so can I ask a question?
Uh-huh.
From your generation, Generation Z,
uh-huh,
who would you say is the most punk anti-establishment figure? Who is sticking it to the man? Who would never, never sell out?
Don't know.
You don't know? Why not?
Because every other day you see someone screw it up. Every other day you see someone on Twitter or on Instagram or whatever, someone you admire, someone you look up to, just go against what their fans believe, or go against what they have made themselves out to believe. You see someone out there who you admire, who you like, he's cool, you think he's cool, you think he's chill, nah, he supports his, no, and you see, he's cool, nah, he's a s**tist. You see, just every other day you see someone selling out, or you see someone saying some stupid stuff about the state of the world, and at this point, it's impossible to tell if the person who you think is punk and cool is actually punk and cool, or is just doing it for attention and to be able to be liked by the younger generation so that they still have a name in today's media. And for that reason, my answer is Brendan Lee Mulligan.
I don't know who Brendan Lee Mulligan is.
Brendan Lee Mulligan is a...
Brennan?
Brennan Lee Mulligan is a comedian and activist from New York who currently works... God damn it, dog. Brennan Lee Mulligan is a... I'm going to let you sit down, Darcy. She's behind you.
Darcy, come and sit down.
I was going on a cool rant there.
Good girl. Brennan Lee Mulligan?
Brennan Lee Mulligan is a... activist and comedian from New York, most known for appearing on the streaming service Dropout and their title series Game Changer, which, if you haven't watched it, is probably one of the best TV shows on air right now. They're currently airing their, I want to say, 8th season, and it's some of the funniest, most creative stuff I've seen in a while. Oh, it's an incredible show. It's gone from a tiny show in an office building in LA to having its entire own studio with a bunch of spin-offs, and it's just an incredible show. Anyways, Brendan Lee Mulligan, comedian, actor, activist. He was one of the leading voices during the SAG-AFTRA strikes back a few years ago when actors were campaigning against AI. He has been incredibly vocally left-wing, and he has shown support for Zoran Mamdani, as well as many left-leaning, very socialist activists and politicians in Los Angeles and in New York, where he's originally from. He is the dungeon master and creator of the TV show Dimension 20, which is one of the large D&D shows out there, and he cannot go 2 episodes without having an anti-capitalist message in it.
Okay, so that sounds pretty punk and pretty cool.
He's awesome.
Okay, what if... Mm-hmm. In 10 years, 20 years, he goes to the White House. Trump will be dead by then. But he goes to the White House and he accepts what is then called the Trump Medal of Honor. And he sits down and he talks about, you know, his memories of Trump and how amazing Trump was. And he absolutely sells himself to what you consider to be the opposite of what he is at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
How would that make you feel?
That would make me and all of the fans of him and his image realize that he has in fact been replaced by a robotic clone and we need to destroy it immediately and find the real Brennan.
Okay.
He would want me to say that, I think. That's the kind of he would come up with.
We're going to have to beat that too.
High school archetypes change, and a lot of the references in what we think of as like high school stuff are cultural artifacts.
True.
Like this idea of teens being like super bad, like let's go party, is part of it. But I work at a summer camp still, and all the teens I know are depressed queer socialists, which I don't see reflected pretty much anywhere in high school media.
Yeah, totally.
Let's get the movie about the last day of senior year with a bunch of depressed queer socialists getting together for some direct action, like
for
aiding in a labor strike, canvassing, something like that. That'd be awesome.
At the start of this episode, we asked the question, what do celebrities owe us? And the answer was, absolutely nothing. And that stands. What have celebrities given us? Their talent, their time, their energy, great joy, laughs. And in turn, because of that, they have been acknowledged and celebrated by the institutions that run this country and others. And that annoys us, because these people who we thought were like us have turned their backs on us and moved into these elevated circles with higher status, and they move beyond us and they're not like us anymore. And that feels bad. And I get it. And I've felt it. But why? Why are they doing that? Well, a myriad of reasons. Sam Neill, as we've discussed, did it because he just thought, you know what? Give me my knighthood. I might be at the end of my life. Okay, go on then. And it made him feel good. And I think that's wonderful. Sir Billy Connolly didn't even realise he had a knighthood. Sir Billy Connolly. For a lifetime of making us laugh, of giving us joy. Yeah, absolutely. Give the man a knighthood. Armando Iannucci, CBE. Now, this is a man who grew up streets from where I am just now, whose father wrote for an anti-fascist newspaper in Italy, whose mother was a hairdresser here in Glasgow. He went to the same primary school as Billy Connolly, albeit decades apart. This is a man of impeccable character, impeccable education, who has given us so much. And he had so much backlash because he accepted his honours to make his mother feel good. Do we have the right to stand in judgment of that? No, we don't. He was offered it. He took it. And that's fine. That's okay. It doesn't change a single second of his work. Sir Billy doesn't stop being a giant of comedy just because he's got a knighthood. Sir Paul McCartney doesn't stop being a man who literally changed the face of music just because he accepted a knighthood. Sir Mick Jagger doesn't stop being the most punk thing that ever happened to rock and roll in the 60s. It was so cool. Just because he accepted the knighthood. And Keith Richards is not wrong for being ticked off about that. In fact, it's funny. It's a matter of personal choice. That's what it comes down to. On the part of the people whose efforts, whose talents, whose time has been acknowledged, it's a matter of personal choice on their parts whether or not they accept their honours. And we don't get to say that they're right or wrong, or that the body of work somehow has less value whether they do or they don't.
They're still exactly who they were when they were born. And they'll still be exactly who they are when they die. They just have some letters before and after their name. That's all. That's all that it is. But I can tell you that if my child accepted a knighthood, would I be proud? Dear God, no. Dear God, no. I'd be horrified. Would I stop them? No, of course not. Of course not. Would I go with them to Buckingham Palace on the day and wear a stupid dress? Also no. Would I be happy for them? Yeah, of course I would. Of course I would. Because it's my baby. And I am sure that the phenomenally talented, intelligent and wonderful Armando Iannucci's mother was just bursting with pride when he accepted his honours. And that's worth it, isn't it? This podcast was written, edited and produced by me, Wendy Jordan and Paul Whitelaw, featuring contributions from Justin Lewis, David Myers and Sprite Kirkwood. If you enjoy the podcast, please tell somebody, give us 5 stars and a review. We'll love you forever.
I am so disappointed in you.